Okay, I want to call to order the House Education Interim Committee for Monday, May 23rd. And so anyway, welcome everybody. And before we get going with the program, I would actually like to introduce, we have some visitors here from Willamette High School in Bethel in the Eugene area. So I'd like to welcome the class of Mr. Nelson's. The students are seniors in his AP Government and Politics class at Willamette. And the class is mostly focused on the policymaking process. So we're pleased that you're able to observe, although we're not going to be voting on policy today, at least seeing what how your state government works. So I'd like to extend courtesies to Mr. Nelson's class. So thank you very much. Okay, with that, what we've got a lot of hearings this morning, or this afternoon, some informational presentations, and what we're going to start out with, well, first of all, welcome back, you guys, welcome back. Some informational meetings, and so we are going to open the informational meeting on REAP Student Leadership Day, and so we would like to bring up Mr. Jackson and the students at his direction that want to come up. Thank you, welcome again. And you can bring up more chairs if you'd like.
Chair Doherty, thank you so much. Dr. Miller, I'm just going to be a little brief here and just say, again, thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you all.
Okay, and make sure you re-identify yourself for the record.
Mark Jackson, Executive Director for REAP Incorporated. I'm glad to be here. I'm joined with both students and staff at a middle school level, and they're going to pretty much present. I'm just about the way and say again, thank you for your time. It's always a pleasure to have our students come every year to just talk about their experience in schools. And with that being said, I'll turn it over to the REAP students. Thank you.
Okay. And what we're going to have you guys do is when you're speaking, you need to be up by the microphone. So you may have to play like musical chairs. And the microphones are very sensitive, so just put them down a little bit, but they can be like this far away from here. Perfect. And make sure that before you speak that you identify yourself for the record. Okay, who's going to go first?
Hello. Hi. I'm Tori Somsonith. I'm a sixth grader at Ron Russell Middle School, and I'm a REAP ambassador.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Lena Din. I am a sixth grader at Ron Russell Middle School, and I'm also a sixth grade REAP ambassador.
Hi, I'm Zanuba Abubakar. I am a sixth grader at Ron Russell Middle School, and I'm also a sixth grade REAP ambassador.
Hi, my name is Aspen Pierce. I am a sixth grade student at Ron Russell Middle School, and I am a REAP ambassador.
Hello, my name is Skylar Smith. I am from Ron Russell Middle School, a sixth grader student, and I am a REAP ambassador.
Okay, and one more.
Hi, I'm Emma Law. I'm a sixth grader at Ron Russell Middle School, and I am a sixth grade REAP ambassador.
Okay, so thank you. So go forth and let us know what's going on. Thank you.
So the first thing we would like to talk about is how REAP has made a very big impact on our lives. REAP stands for basically the next wave of leadership, and it really helps to build our confidence, and it has helped help us learn about leadership so that we can like help other kids with other things. One thing we
And if you want to say your name again, so we know who's speaking.
I'm Zanuba, and one thing we did do for while we were a sixth grade ambassador, we helped the fifth graders out and visit their elementary, so we could tell them all about sixth grade from our school, and even from different schools for all the Ron Russell students.
Hi, I'm Lena, and I would like to add on to that. We also made a video for the fifth graders, and everyone made advice to help the fifth graders out so they know more about Ron Russell and its community, and everyone was also starting it. We also had student directors and student editors, so everyone was able to help out with the video.
I'm Aspen. We believe that the video helped the students get used to the large transition from elementary school to Ron Russell Middle School. It helps them with the rules. It helps them with homework if they're worried about it. It helps with any concerns they have or anything like that.
Okay.
Recommendations.
We have some other, go ahead.
We have some recommendations, so.
Okay, and make sure you say your name again, because they say we can see you, but the recordings don't know who you are.
My name is Tori, and we have some recommendations that we think would help to improve our school and help all the students. Something that we think that would help is to have, like, allow the students some time to take home any technology, because at school nowadays, there's technology has really improved, and we do a lot of things on, like, Chromebooks and iPads, and not all kids have the technology at their homes, mm-hmm. so... We want to allow them to be able to do their work at home as well.
I'm Aspen. We believe that we should have free internet access to all students on free reduced lunch.
Hi, I'm Lena. I would like to talk about more interactive work time, which is I feel like maybe each kid should have some time to have one-on-one with the teacher, because sometimes they might not understand. So if maybe they might feel more comfortable just talking to the teacher themselves. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that would be helpful.
A note on that, different students have all, like, they should have, like, hands-on activities for different students' learning styles, because all students learn differently.
I'm Aspen, and with the students that learn differently, there are three main learning styles: visual, kinesthetic, and auditory, which is hearing. And with smaller classes and more hands-on activities, children with kinesthetic learning abilities, which is physical, or hands-on, they will be able to get a higher advance on their learning abilities.
Hi, I'm Tori again. So one more recommendation that we have is on crosswalks. There are crosswalks by our school, one on 112th Powell, and they're not, we believe that they should become safer, like have light up crosswalks so that it can show when a student will be crossing or just someone in general.
I'm Aspen, especially with the crosswalks in the wintertime when it's dark in the mornings and it gets dark early at night. People who want to cross across the street safely, they would want to be able to be seen by drivers.
Okay.
In order to keep REAP going, we would need to be able to have some funding because it is a nonprofit organization.
Because it's a nonprofit organization, with the donations to help fund, if we keep this program going, we can help a lot of other kids who would like to do things like this to help other people.
Okay. We have more?
I think we're done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else that you guys would like to add? Okay, do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, folks. You did a great job on that. I am curious, however, what was your top advice to the fifth graders?
Top advice?
Yeah, what was the main thing that you told them that you thought that they really needed to know?
We told them that they shouldn't be worried to come into this big place, and like that they shouldn't be worried about any bullying or like homework or things that will be hard, because we have a very safe environment in our school.
Okay, excellent.
Nice, thank
very
you.
Good. Any other comments? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, you mentioned free internet access, I think. What do you have right now available to you?
In our classrooms, we have iPads in social studies classes, and we have Chromebooks in language arts and math classes. So all of our textbooks are on the iPads for social studies, and all of our presentations are, they are like PowerPoints. And we need internet to do that. And for our research, we don't have many textbooks in paper available, so all of our textbooks are online, so that's where we take notes. That's where we cite our evidence and stuff like that. So if we were to access that at home, some people who do not have Wi-Fi or internet access at their house could possibly get a lower grade because of their availability to internet.
Okay.
And are these also, can you take the Chromebooks and the iPads home, or do you have to keep them at class?
For now, we have to keep them in school. Everything stays in class, and we can't, if we need to go in for recess, or we would have to go into the classroom and get a pass to use them.
And we're hoping that you can change that for us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Reardon.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say thank you for coming in. Some of these beautiful, brilliant kids actually may be from my district.
Oh, I thought they were all from Tigard.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But I thought it was really great that you guys asked to do more homework, and because you want those computers so you can do more homework, right?
Sure.
Okay, okay, good. Just a real quick question, seriously. You talked about, you know, wanting more one-on-one time with your teachers and so forth. Do you know anything about how many, the level of counseling services that you have, like how many counselors per student? Do you happen to know that, or do you work with your counselors very much?
Well, we have two counselors at our school.
Yeah.
And if we were to need to talk to them about anything, we would have to fill out a form to go see them.
And most counselors, they don't really teach us. It's a good thing, like, to ask counselors how you're feeling, if you feel bullied, but, like, for counselors to ask us for, like, their math, it's kind of hard to explain because they're just counselors.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, we thank you very much. We always look forward to you guys visiting us every year, and hopefully you've had a good day in Salem and learned lots, and you'll go back to your classmates and tell them all about it. So anyway, anything else? Yes. Is it picture time, or do we have some? You are speaking, sirs? Yeah.
All right, good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the House Education Committee. I am Anderson Du Bois, the REAP site coordinator for the Reflections Program at Boise Elliott Humboldt School, a historically black K-8 school in Portland, Oregon. And so as you guys may already know, the mission of REAP is to proactively ignite, elevate, and engage the next wave of leaders for the future now. And so something that's been amazing is that REAP has already been able to engage me in the community working with the school. And as I was a past student, just like they were back when I was in high school. And so I work to develop young leaders of the future through REAP's reflection, restorative justice curriculum, and the inspiration, and through the inspiration that HB 2192 and SB 553 provides, we have moved forward in redefining the way discipline in schools is executed via our school suspension program. And so we've already begun to see improvements in the data. Our success outcomes are as follows. 50% of students in our program do not repeat attendance due to an infraction. 77% of students in the program do not repeat after a second time. And 80% of the students who enter into the program don't reenter for the same infraction. And so the impact for students is more instructional hours in school as a result of in-school suspension. Students aren't just sitting at home, they're connecting with a staff member like myself. We have reports that there is improved school climate from school administration all the way to the teachers and some students as well. As a result, four other PPS schools have formed a collaborative effort to have REAP's reflection program implemented in their schools. We simply ask for a few things, that you consider the following. If you could please visit some of our programs at one of our school sites, support REAP's application for HB 2016 funding, sponsor a legislative bill to allocate funding to support REAP programming focused on entrepreneurship, civic engagement, leadership, and restorative justice to aid in the expansion of positive outcomes that I've previously outlined, as well as these bright young students. Please work with us as we engage culturally diverse and low-income students in college and career readiness programs. And thank you for your time and consideration. Any questions?
Thank you. Do you have any questions for this young man? Representative Frederick.
I will actually not make a question. The school that he works with is in my district, and it has been through quite a few iterations over the past several decades.
Yeah.
It will go through another one from what I can gather. But there's a commitment that's clearly there to try to make things better for the kids and the families and the community that's there. So REAP has been very much a part of that.
Good. Now, I've been out there a couple of times, and it's a good school. It's a good school. Okay. Anyway, thank you guys very much for coming, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so with that, I close the informational meeting, our hearing on REAP, Student Leadership Day. And I will open up an informational hearing on ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act. And we have Dr. Knorr. And do we have Ms. McComb also? Thank you, guys.
That's always a good way to start a committee. Kids are so great.
Welcome.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb, Legislative Director for the Department of Education, and with me is Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor, and I think I'm here to maybe operate the PowerPoint.
Excellent.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jan.
Adults of a certain age are technically challenged, aren't we?
Especially if I'm having to multitask here. Thank you, Chair Doherty, and members of the committee for the opportunity to be before you here today and to share with you some information relative to our state plan on the Every Student Every Student Succeeds Act. And I just want to give you a little bit of background before we jump into the work that's actually underway relative to the state plan. Just want to remind you that this is the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that was established in 1965. This is a civil rights law. It's founded on equity, and it's designed to advance education equity in the state and nationally. It replaces the No Child Left Behind Act. It affords us some flexibility. It actually returns control to the states and local districts in some ways. And it maintains some safeguards relative to the appropriate accountability and responsibility that's been given to the state relative to the implementation of the law. So when we think about the flexibility that's been afforded to us, it tends to fall into four key areas, and that is assessment, accountability, school improvement, and educator effectiveness. We are really excited about the conversations that have been going on across the state relative to these four areas. The law is much broader than that, but these are the areas that tend to really define the quality of the education system that we have as a state. Efforts underway. I just wanted to give you a little bit the timeline that we're under. So the law was authorized in December of 2015. We currently are in the process of engaging stakeholders and communities throughout the state to gather feedback that will help inform the development of the state plan. We are doing that between April and June. Between July and August, we intend to have a draft plan that we will make available to the rest of the state and to you and others to give us some feedback on. And I'll talk a little bit about the structure that we're using to engage stakeholders in this process. Okay, John? Yeah. So this has afforded us an opportunity to really rethink and reimagine education in the state of Oregon, and we purposefully chose to approach the state plan in that fashion instead of just going out and talking about a regulatory function that we have to fulfill as an agency and as a state. We invited Oregonians throughout the state to talk about reimagining education that's based on their values, their beliefs, values, and expectations and hopes and dreams for their students. So we have a structured process that consists of four work groups in the areas that I mentioned earlier. We have a non-structured process that involves community forums where we go out and engage stakeholders in every corner of the state. We have an advisory committee that will serve in an oversight capacity that considers the recommendations that the four work groups will provide. And then that goes to the State Board of Education and to the governor for signature. And we're also engaging different types of school stakeholders throughout the state. So we have communities that we're engaging in, both rural communities, communities of color, community-based organizations, different groups that we work with as an agency and also in specific program areas like the Community Action Group. And we've reached out to businesses and chambers to engage the business community to solicit their feedback and input into this process. so I'm going to do a couple of things here. I'm going to go over the work groups to give you some specific high-level details relative to the work that the work groups have been doing, and then I'll share with you the feedback that we're receiving from community from the community forums. We provided you copies of material. We have two pagers from every work group that describes where we've been, the conversations that are currently underway, and where we're headed. And we also provided you a high-level summary of some of the major themes that we're gleaning from the community forums that we've conducted so far. So the standards and assessment work group, it's really looking at both long-term priorities and short-term needs, if you will. The long-term priorities revolve around having a balanced system of assessment that includes both summative, interim, and formative assessment. Part of the conversation in the near term is how do we resource schools and provide them support to implement the content standards? How do we provide flexibility for high schools as provided in the law in terms of providing a state assessment other than SBAC? So we have the option to consider ACT, SAT, and perhaps others that will qualify for the high school assessment. We're definitely talking about accessibility support needs for students with special needs, and that requires some type of accommodation in order to successfully complete the assessment. We are also discussing the summative assessment administration policies, and that involves the length of the assessment, the focus of the assessment, the regular implementation of the assessment. So all of those things are currently under discussion within the standards and assessment work group. Okay, next one. The accountability work group is really looking at how we expand our definition of accountability. So currently, accountability is based primarily on student performance on state assessments. So the conversations that we've had in this work group is to look at different ways of rating schools. So currently, schools are rated 1 through 5, and that defines essentially the quality of that school. So they're considering other measures, for example, a dashboard that has lots of different indicators, and there is a continuum that represents where the school is on that continuum. It makes it a lot more holistic. It allows you for both quantitative and qualitative measures of school quality. The group is also discussing the quality of the indicators. Some indicators may be measurable, others are not measurable, so do we treat them the same? The other topics they've identified is the participation rate requirement. What do we do with alternative schools? Currently, alternative schools are lumped together with regular schools in our accountability framework. Should we design something different for alternative schools that take into consideration different variables and indicators? Okay. Our district and school improvement work group is having some really thoughtful conversations about how we identify schools for improvement. How do we support those schools? Currently, we have a formula that's provided to us through our waiver or through No Child Left Behind. ESSA provides us an opportunity to design something that works for us. So we've been involved in school improvement for the last 15 years. Over the last 5 or 6 years, we had a focused effort that identified schools in different ways. So they're building on what we've learned from our own experiences, and they're thinking about how do we design diagnostic systems that really tell us who needs who's an improvement, who needs support, and who isn't. They're thinking about how we partner with school districts to provide this diagnostic service. How do we partner with districts to support schools? And if you go, and then how does the accountability work? So if we're broadening our definition of accountability, how does that actually apply to schools that are in school improvement? Do schools exit school improvement based on the same criteria that we use for them to enter into school improvement, or should we consider different factors and different variables that we measure to determine that they've actually made the progress that we need them to make, or at least have developed a foundation that allow them to continue to make progress? So lots of rich conversation is happening in these groups. The effective educator work group is really looking at Senate Bill 290, looking at the system that we currently have in place in the state of Oregon. Under the flexibility that's been afforded to us with ESSA, we don't have to report on the highly qualified teacher category anymore, but we know we're all interested in having highly qualified teachers and administrators in every school and building in our state. We also want to make sure that the evaluation is purposeful. Currently, the law requires that we link student test performance to teacher evaluation. So the group is looking at that in a very thoughtful way to say what's really the best way to get information that helps the students, that helps the teacher, that helps the school as a whole make progress. So they're looking at Senate Bill 290 and the parameters that have been afforded to us there. They're looking at current practices. They're looking at practices from around the country and discussing the best way to ensure that we have excellent educators and excellent leaders in every building and to make this really meaningful for everyone involved. So great conversations are happening there. The community forums, this was a way for us to really engage Oregonians and to reach out to every corner of the state and learn and understand what communities need and what they think of the key educational issues that they're facing and how we roll those up to a state level that informs the state plan on the one hand, but also informs our work as an agency and hopefully provide you information to inform your work as a legislative body. So we have we've planned on 13 forums. We've completed 9 of those. So I've been to Medford, Redmond, Pendleton, Ontario, Eugene. We've had one in Salem. We've had 2 in Portland. And I may be missing some, but we have 3 more to go. We have 1 in Hood River this week, and then we have 2 on the coast and 1 in Sherwood. So these have been great conversations with communities. You can see who's attending. We have educators, parents, higher education representatives. We've had students at these forums, and the students have actually been absolutely outstanding. I'm always nervous following students because they're so articulate and insightful. But we've had students at these forums, and they've contributed to the conversation in very meaningful and really enlightening ways, I would say. We've had business and community members, and this has been an opportunity for educators really to express their hopes and aspirations for education, to engage community partners in the process, and together come up with a set of recommendations that we are using to help inform our work. So we're actually asking communities 3 questions. You can just go ahead and click on them, Jan. So we're asking them to tell us what school characteristics are most important to them, and we're inviting them to put on whatever hat they come in through the door with. So they could be legislators, they could be board members, parents, teachers, et cetera. We're asking them to think specifically about their perspective and their concern for education. We're asking them, how should we measure school success or school quality? And really asking participants to think deeply and broadly about this work. We're not putting any parameters or boundaries on it. And then the last thing is truly our equity question, which is how do we ensure that all students are successful, no matter where they live, no matter what school they go to, and that they have access to opportunities that we would want for every student in the state of Oregon. So those are the 3 questions that we focus the conversation around. And these are some emerging themes that we're hearing from stakeholders. And I'm only going to share a couple with you today. If you would click on that, Jen. So 2 preliminary themes. One is really about, go ahead and just click on all of them, if you please. Okay, thank you. So what we've heard consistently from all participants and specifically from students is that we want rigorous, relevant, well-rounded, engaging educational experiences for all students. This is something that's been articulated by everybody that participated in these community forums. We also learned that education should personalize and individualize learning in order to ensure students acquire knowledge and skills best suited for their next steps. And these are very clear and very articulate goals that the participants have shared with us. Under rigorous, relevant, and well-rounded, engaging educational experiences, it's about high expectations, it's about enrichment opportunities for students, so we have a well-rounded curriculum that includes math, social studies, language arts, reading, PE, health, music, you name it, and not to narrow the curriculum, but also to expand the opportunities that we're affording students. We heard a lot about safety and learning environment that's inclusive of all students, an environment that's welcoming for parents, students, and the community as a whole. Under the personalized learning experiences, we learned a lot about the importance of CTE to these communities and these schools, the importance of STEM-type opportunities where students are actually engaged in doing things. They see the relevance between what they're doing in school and a career pathway or career goals and aspirations that they have. We learned a lot about having alternative ways of delivering instruction, alternative ways of teaching and learning that accommodate the individual needs of the students. students, and that is in the form of CTE, but also bringing the community into the school, taking the school into the community and building those relationships. And we heard a lot about supports that are needed for teachers, for school staff, for educators in general, and how the community can actually be a vehicle to providing those supports and shoring up the services and the opportunities that we're affording students. So next steps for us is that we're going to continue these community engagement conversations and stakeholder conversations. The work groups will continue to convene. We're in the process of convening our ESSA advisory group. This is a group of community partners, educators, stakeholders from around the state, really representing practically every community around the state. We're going to share with them the recommendations from the work groups. We're going to engage them relative to key issues that perhaps the work groups need some guidance and direction on. And we're going to continue to solicit feedback from educators and the public. We intend to have a state plan draft by August, September of 2016, and then go out again and share that with the public and give them opportunities to comment and provide input. We will be ready to submit once we receive final guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, which is expected to be October of 2016. Perhaps we will be able to submit November, December of 2016. All right, I went through this really quickly. I wanted to be mindful of your time constraints. I'm happy to answer any questions and receive any comments that you have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative McLean.
Well, I know you're under a time limit, and so it's a very ambitious schedule. And it looks, and because the waiver stops in December, so I know we have to have something in place. But I'm hoping that there is some kind of a backup plan or some kind of a transitional plan, that if there are some issues that are really coming out when the draft plan comes out that we need to discuss a little longer or better, that we can figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. Because, that is, you can't take 200 pages of a waiver and a brand new set of goals and standards, you know, from one group and expect us to be able to do that, you know, in less than 11 months. Yeah. So I'm hoping that you feel sort of the same way, that we have some way to make sure we've got a safety net.
Mm-hmm. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, you're absolutely right. We have anticipated that there may be a need to give us a little bit more time to ponder what sticking issues may arise, and recognizing the enormity of the task. So we've given ourselves some cushion, if you will. Okay. That's why we're aiming for a draft in August, and we hope to have more public engagement. And I believe we'll have from August, September to December to refine whatever we need to refine. The good news is that once our plan goes to the U.S. Department of Education, we will have additional time to implement the accountability system. Of course, it has to be approved by the U.S. Department of Education. So the plan goes in 2016, but the accountability system doesn't actually kick in until 2017-18. So hopefully we'll still have some wiggle room, and we would look to work with the U.S. Department of Education to negotiate for more time if we needed to. So, yeah.
Can I make one other comment?
Okay,
thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You can make two more.
Okay. Well, the comment that I wanted to make was that I think this is the sixth time, you know, I've had presentations around ESSA, and we've had two or three local groups that have had teachers and community members involved. And one of the things that I heard over and over again, and I think I'm hearing it in one of your comments, but it was that we need more choices of, you know, what we used to call, you know, your electives.
Yes.
And that it's not just STEM or STEAM, mm-hmm. but that there are other electives out there that folks really value and they really believe are those real world experiences, and that they'd like to see us concentrate on more than just one definition mm-hmm. of what STEM and STEAM might mean. Mm-hmm. So.
Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, you're absolutely right. We've heard that from students. We've heard it from community members. And it's about education being local mm-hmm. and allowing them the flexibility to design whatever programs and systems and opportunities they want to afford students based on their needs and based on the community's capacity. Absolutely.
Good to hear. Okay. Representative Hack, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for all your work that you're doing on this. Just a couple of things. You talked about the meetings around the state and that STEM kept coming up. I'm an early childhood proponent, too. Love that.
Yes.
So I didn't see anything in your proposal in regards to early childhood and the importance of that. So I'm kind of curious if you've heard much on that or where you're at there a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative Hack. Early childhood education for the first time is really part of this new law. So we did talk about it in communities throughout the state, and it did come up in terms of the need to make sure that we have alignment between early childhood education and K-12, to make sure that we have collaboration between early childhood providers and K-12 to make sure that students are ready. So it did actually come up practically in every community forum. And my report touches on just a couple of broad themes, but there are a lot more specificity that we can provide once we essentially input all of the data that we've collected and start to code it. I believe you will see a constant theme relative to early childhood education.
Okay. Can I have another?
Please.
As it relates to school improvement plans, you'd indicated that you're looking at and having conversation about how you get off of an improvement mm-hmm. plan. So are you looking to change how that's been done in the past? Is there a new way that you feel might be better than what we've done? Because I know there's been a lot of work put into that over the years, and so I'm just curious if there's going to be a big change in that or what that looks like.
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, I really can't forecast for you what the committee will actually come up with. What I can tell you is that they're having some really thoughtful conversations relative to the overall flexibility that's been afforded to us, especially in the assessment, especially under the area of accountability and what the report card potentially could look like. So what they're basically discussing is that should we use the same indicators to exit schools that we used for them, that essentially identified them as in need of improvement? And I think that's really a good question, because once, based on our experience of working with schools that are identified as focus and priority, we identify different inputs typically when we start to move them towards improvement. You're looking at curriculum, you're looking at professional development, you're looking at class size, and a lot of other factors, but those are not the same ones that actually we use to determine whether they need to be in improvement or not. So I think the conversation is around how do we look at this holistically, how do we use diagnostic tools to really tell us what that school actually needs, and how do we focus their improvement efforts on the things that will make the biggest difference. So I think it's really an opportunity for us to refine our thinking and our approach to identifying schools that go into school improvement and what actually gets them out of school improvement. The other thing that the committee is discussing is essentially the labeling that goes on when a school actually is mm-hmm. identified in improvement. We've approached it as a partnership between the department and the local school district and the school. So if we changed the way we think about that and the way we look at it, we may actually have schools wanting to stay, for the lack of a better term, I will call it an improvement status, mm-hmm. because that means they get more support from the state, they get more focused attention, and they have additional resources that we can bring to bear to help them improve. So I think they're just thinking about it holistically, and they're grappling with that in terms of what is the school improvement criteria, how long should a school be in school improvement, how can we exit them if we notice that they're making the right progress in the right areas. So,
I think that's great. I appreciate that. And I think it's important that we don't exit them too soon, because mm-hmm. a lot of times they're in such a hurry to get off because it is a black mark, so to speak. But really, I'm glad to hear you saying that, and hopefully it won't be considered that as much, and a way that we can move kids forward. One last thing, then I'm done. Some constituents have come to me and are concerned that while they appreciate the forums and going out and talking to folks, one of the concerns that keeps coming back to me is we're asking questions to a failed system. We're out asking how we fix something to the folks that it's already broken for. So I don't want to assume anything, but I guess when they ask that question, I want to be able to say, yes, we understand that, but it's valuable information, which I do believe that it is, mm-hmm. but that's not going to be your driving force in the decisions that you make completely, I would assume. I would hope you're looking at best practice that not only, looking outside of Oregon even to say what's working and maybe really looking at our schools. I mean, not all Oregon schools are not doing well. That's, people have a misconception that everything's bad. So I just wanted your perspective on that to kind of give me something that I can reassure folks with.
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, I really appreciate the question. And I think the biggest challenge that we're experiencing with this transformation that we're going through is that it's a cultural shift. It's a cultural shift at the local level. It's a cultural shift at the state level. I can tell you for a fact that many of the work groups struggled at first to think outside the box. I had a community forum, I won't tell you in which community, where I sat with superintendents, principals, and teachers on, and at one table where they couldn't get out of the NCLB box. So we've tried to stretch people, and we've told them, we want you to think big, we want you to think deeply and creatively about this. There are no bad ideas. I've reached out to my colleagues in schools and districts and advised them to convey to their representatives that are sitting on these work groups to think really, really big and to be bold. And that's what we've encouraged them to do. We do manage expectations by saying, yes, we're going to use this information. We can't use all of it. We can't put all of it in the state plan, but we will use the most pertinent feedback to inform the state plan. But what we've also told them is that we will use this information to inform our work at the Department of Education, to inform the work of the State Board of Education relative to policies and barriers that may be standing in the way, and also to inform your work as a legislature. So those are the messages that we've conveyed, and we intend to do that. We intend to come to you with information about what we're learning. We intend to have that inform our policy work, our policy action packages, our legislative concepts. And we've started to have conversations with the state board around high school graduation, around barriers that may be keeping students from accessing certain curriculum and certain opportunities. I think the large-scale change that many of the participants wanted to see really has to come from the local districts and the local communities. And that's what we've also learned, that education is very local. So we have a state system, but we have 197 school districts, and they're very different from each other. So we, and the last thing I will say is that that's why we presented this as an opportunity to reimagine education in the state of Oregon. That's what we've labeled each and every one of those community forums. We're here to reimagine education. We're not here to tell you how it should be or how it ought to be or what it should look like. We want you to tell us what's important to you. And I think there is value in that conversation happening locally as much as there is value for that information to inform our work. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question, but we're thinking about it in a very broad and open way. So
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. A number of the things that I've been concerned about over the years are starting to show up in some of the phrasing and some of the approach. And it is a change in the culture. I look at a couple of the phrases that I see here, the need to move away from a one-size-fits-all model and towards a K-12 system of options that meets the needs of our diverse student population. That's not just rhetoric, I hope.
No.
I want to make sure that this is, in fact, something that actually happens. And it is a change looking at the individual needs of the kids. I really appreciate that. The second one that I want to quote is from the article, from the one regarding the teacher, what is it called here, just a second, teacher effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Shifting from a model of compliance to a system focused on growth for all schools and districts that is rooted in asset-based language rather than the current deficit-based approach. That's huge. That is huge. And I can understand why you might have had some of your fellow superintendents and others balk at that, because that's not what they've been told to do over the last almost 20 years.
Right.
So this is a real change for them, and I am very pleased to see it. Now the question is, how do we put it into action? And that's going to be difficult, and whether we as a legislature provide the resources for you to do that. I'll tell you, with those two phrases, I am very pleased with what I'm seeing. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for all your work on this. And I did attend one of the meetings, and Salam is a master of presenting, and was really key is that he didn't just present. He stayed there and was interacting with people at every table, so very much a part of the process. One of the previous change agents didn't behave quite that way, and so I appreciate that. I really took note of your personal involvement in it. Having said that, so you're talking about reimagining education. That's good. Who do you know specifically from your sign-in sheets? Who's attending the meetings? By breakdown, you know, is there a balance of parents, teachers, students? You know, how that's broken down? And then on the committee, are they balanced as well? If we're going to reimagine something, we need to get, we want a broad perspective. If I was protecting something, I might try to pack the room. So could you comment?
Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, thank you so much for your comments and for your question. So this gives you a sense of the percentage of participants. They have been predominantly educators. We've had teachers, counselors, superintendents, principals participating in the community forums. And the next largest group is community members. And quite often we had individuals that can put on multiple hats. So they're a parent, they're a community member, they're a business that actually hires students from the school district. They could be somebody that works at a college or university. But we had fairly diverse groups, but we had a lot of educators attending those community forums. And we were really candid with them to say, this is about elevating your voice. We want to hear from you. We want you to help inform our thinking relative to the plan, but the education system in general. So we've had fairly diverse representation of a variety of participants. I want to underscore the importance of the student voices in these forums. We've had FFA students in particular at every one of those forums. We had some Somali students at the one in Portland, and I started a tradition by allowing them to close the community forum. So typically a student actually speaks last. And I have to share with you how impressed I am with our students, and especially our FFA students. They're articulate, they're concise, they demonstrate a great deal of empathy for their fellow students, they demonstrate empathy for teachers in the building, and I even joked with them and said, next time we have to do a plan, I think we're just going to get 60 FFA students to come to Salem, put them up for 6 weeks, and just ask them to write the plan, because they're incredibly insightful. On the work groups, we have fairly diverse representation of educators. That includes teachers, administrators, district-level administrators, building and district-level administrators. We have community members that are participating on those work groups. We have advocacy groups that are participating on the work groups. We issued a developed an application process, and within 2 weeks we received 300 applications. And we had originally anticipated having work groups of 20 to 25 people, and some of these work groups have 40 people on them. So we have about 160 people participating on the work groups, and they do represent school staff, community-based organizations. We have racial and ethnic diversity on each one of those work groups. We have business members on each one of those work groups. We have colleges and universities participating. We have CTE teachers and CTE administrators. So it's a fairly diverse group of stakeholders that are helping us think through the key elements of the plan and think through how we take advantage of the flexibility that we've been afforded.
So. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else? Quickly, because we need to move on.
I just wanted Dr. Noor to know that the FFA curriculum includes both a speech and a parliamentary procedure unit, or two or three or four, and a couple of contests as well that are all speech-oriented. So those good skills that you're seeing might be communication skills, too.
They certainly are, and they're absolutely outstanding.
And those of you who don't know, FFA is Future Farmers of America. So.
Right. Although if you ask the student, Chair Doherty, they will tell you they're the future leaders of America.
That's right.
Thank you very much. Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Two shameless plugs.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate all of your work on this and look forward to seeing what the results are going
Absolutely.
To be.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. With that, I close the informational hearing on ESSA and open up an informational meeting on school facility expenditures. So we have State Treasurer Wheeler, Rick Krager, and Michael Elliott. Welcome, current treasurer and future mayor-elect Wheeler.
Future everybody's. Big room.
Chair Dory. We're not used to seeing you in education, so welcome.
Well, it's good to be seen, and welcome back. Chair Dory and members of the committee, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the treasurer for the state of Oregon. I'm here to introduce and show my support for what I think is a great partnership between the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon State Treasury. As you'll recall, in 2015, you passed Senate Bill 447. It created the opportunity for the state to invest in local school facilities and address significant deferred maintenance and capital needs at the local school district level. The legislature, upon the passage of that bill, subsequently authorized $126.2 million in general obligation bonding authority to be sold under Article 11P of the Oregon State Constitution to fund the effort. In this partnership, the Treasury and the Department of Education created the Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Program, otherwise known as AWESOME. This program is committed to investing in local communities and ensuring all districts are treated fairly and equitably. While this type of investment is new, we have some history of leveraging the tools we have at our disposal to support Oregon school districts in their capital investments. For example, the Treasury operates the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program. It allows districts to use the credit rating of the state to secure better rates for their local bonds. The program ensures investors that in the unlikely event of a district default, the state will step up and provide payments to the investors. This, of course, allows the districts to have lower borrowing costs because there's less risk to those who are actually buying the bonds. I'm pleased to report that since the beginning of the school bond guarantee program, no participating district has ever defaulted on their bonds. Assisting school districts in meeting their capital needs is good not only for schools, but as you're all keenly aware, it's good for the communities as well. The Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Program encourages voters at the local level to support their school facilities because they know their money will go farther as a result of the state match. Too often, we find that communities are unable to afford increases in taxes that are necessary to fully fund the improvements of their school facilities. The AWESOME program provides millions of dollars in matching grants, rewarding local residents for investing in their school facilities with additional funds and giving communities a chance to do more with less. As state treasurer, it's part of my job to also ensure that state funds are prudently managed, and we take that role in managing our state's debt very seriously. Under the AWESOME program, no funds are distributed to the districts until all of the necessary agreements are in place. In addition, we only offer funds through reimbursement, so we know exactly how the funds are being spent and we know what work is being completed. With these controls in place, the AWESOME program will continue to manage public funds prudently and responsibly. During the election last week, there were 22 school districts that had bond measures on their local ballots. That's more school districts than any election cycle since November of 2008. 13 of those 22 districts approved their bond measures. $52.5 million in state funds will be provided to augment the $258 million in local general obligation bonds that were approved by voters. We think this is great news for the program. And as the program develops and more school districts and more voters learn about this opportunity, we anticipate that we'll be able to continue to leverage these resources to see critical improvements to school infrastructure. This will mean real improvements for Oregon students. It's important for the health of our state to be able to incentivize local investments in infrastructure. Investments in infrastructure, like school facilities, also means that there are opportunities for job growth and economic development in these communities throughout the state. I'm obviously very excited about this program, and I'm proud that the Treasury has been able to work with the Department of Education to make this happen. In closing, I'd like to thank you all for authorizing and funding this program and giving me an opportunity to be here to speak about it it today. I'm going to now turn it over to the gentlemen to my left, who are the true experts from the Oregon Department of Education.
Would you go ahead and proceed? Thank you.
Pardon?
Your name and proceed, please.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I am the Assistant Superintendent, Finance Administration for the Department of Education. To my left here is Michael Elliott. He is our School Facilities Coordinator. And first off, I want to just say thank you to the Treasurer for being here today. And more importantly, the Treasury has been a phenomenal partner in this. I really can't say enough about the assistance that they have provided us. Department of Education, prior to this, have not traditionally been a bond issuing agency, and they came in right after the passage of Senate Bill 447 and have really been a huge support to us as we have had a tremendous amount of work that we've had to do in a very, very short period of time. So I truly appreciate he and his leadership and his staff for all the work that they have done. I also want to provide a lot of thanks to the Oregon School Board Association. They have been a phenomenal partner on this. I know that they, prior with Senate Bill 447, they were a huge advocate for this particular legislation, and they have also continued to be very helpful in the implementation of this. Also, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, as well as the Oregon Education Association, all have been partners with us. They have been on our advisory boards. They have been providing assistance throughout this entire process. So just as a little background to Senate Bill 447, as the Treasurer had mentioned, a key piece of legislation, and part of that legislation was multifaceted. There was a variety of different responsibilities put on us. First and foremost was the establishment of the Office of School Facilities. We as a department did not have a facility school presence, and so with the passage of 447, we were granted 4.5 FTE to actually provide and set up that office to carry out the responsibilities of Senate 447, all the duties and responsibilities. Mike Elliott is our first hire out of that particular office, and we've been successful with one other position in bringing that up to line. But they have been key members in terms of actually doing the implementation portion of Senate Bill 447. As the Treasurer also already spoke to, as we've fondly called the AWESOME program, had $126 million that was authorized to us to issue general obligation bonds this biennium for the purposes of the matching program. And of course, that was the largest task that we were looking at. But in addition to that, we also were charged with providing technical assistance and establishing standards for areas such as facility assessments and long-range facility plans for all the school districts. One of the most important elements of this is that our projects are done well and that they are put in place with a very top-notch capital assessments plan as well as true quality facility assessment. So part of the program was establishing those standards, but also providing dollars. In addition to setting up the Office of School Facilities, we were provided $1.8 million from the state school fund to actually do grants for technical assistance. That program is just now underway. We will be putting our first allocation of money out in September, but again, these are grants that are going to be specifically focused on providing facility assessments, seismic assessments, capital long-range plans. Going forward, they will be very, very helpful to our school districts in planning for future projects. Also, in addition, in Senate Bill 447, we were assigned to establishing a database so that we can begin collecting better information across the state as it relates to the state of all of our facilities. We've used, up to this point, studies that were done in the past through the seismic assessment. I think numbers of in the neighborhood of $8 billion in needs around seismic upgrades has been identified, and that's just seismic. So we're not talking about some of the community needs, some of the deferred maintenance issues. So certainly that has been what we've had to this point. We're hoping going forward with more and more information and populating this database with all the collection, we'll be able to provide much better information to the legislature going forward. And then finally, the last responsibility piece was a hardship fund for those more emergency situations. They all happen at times. Unfortunately, that particular program is not funded at this point. That will be something that the legislature will have to have discussions with in the future. But at this point, that program will remain dormant until we're able to get some form of funding to move that forward. Over the last 9 months, as it relates to the implementation of the OSMM program, we've done, as already been stated, a tremendous amount of work. We've had to develop administrative rules and get those put in place. We've created a funding formula and a priority list based on legislative guidance. So specifically, 447 told us how to prioritize these fundings and also how to establish the funding formula. We mapped and implemented a funding process that aligned with the election. One of the things I want to point out about this particular program is different than others. As opposed to just getting capital money and going out with a process and making dollars available, this program has to be in conjunction with election cycle. The purpose of it is to provide a commitment to our local school districts so that they can go out and say the state is there as a partner with them and incentivize the passage of the local bonds. Also, we have done a tremendous amount of work in terms of developing our grant agreements and getting our actual bonding finance presence up and running. So we feel very, very good about the progress that has been made. As I said, with the way this program is put together and having to be in conjunction with the election cycle, we were already behind the eight ball a little bit when the money came forward. If we were going to get the November of 2015 election, we were going to have to put something together in quite a bit of speed that we weren't prepared to do. So we knew that we were going to have to bypass the November 2015 election. But the May 2016 was only 6 months away, so still a lot of work that we had to start early. But we were successful, and I think as the treasurer has already alluded to, we saw 22 school districts that we were able to provide commitments or at least put on a waiting list as it relates to this last election. That's the most that we have seen since 2008, again, as the treasurer had alluded to. Another piece was that we've seen historically about 51% of those school districts that put measures forward passed. In this last election cycle, we saw 59%, slightly under 60%, that actually passed. So we were very, very happy to see that of those 22, 13 of the districts actually passed their bond bill. Four of the districts that passed had not issued bonds in over 20 years. So again, another piece of another important goal of Senate Bill 447 was to really help those school districts, particularly those in rural areas that had not issued bonds in the past. And again, we have seen some good success with that so far. So we provided some information for you, I believe, that was passed around, and I think you saw the map and the allocation of the resources. I think you see a good geographic distribution of it. Seven of the districts that we saw were doing safety and security upgrades, five districts building new buildings, five districts working on important building systems, roofs, irrigation systems, four districts doing renovations or remodeling. So again, we had a nice disbursements of different types of projects. I guess in my closing remarks, one of the things that I want to leave you with and that I think is very, very valuable about this program, this last election cycle, we put $52.5 million out. With that, we had $258 million of local leverage. So just from a mathematical standpoint, for every dollar we put in, we've seen a leverage of about five. So that in itself, I think, is a very important element to the program going forward. But taking it a step further is from a multiplier effect. And we talk about all the benefits that this money provides for our schools, for our children, putting them in safe and decent schools throughout Oregon, but there is also economic multiplier here in terms of the jobs and the economic tax base that it grows. What we've used primarily is for every dollar, we see about $1.45 in economic multiplier. So if you just take the $310 million of total bonds that we'll put out, that's another $450 million just in economic benefits. So again, I just want to point out that we have huge benefits for our schools. There's huge need out there, but this is also a tremendous economic engine as well. So in closing, again, I just want to say thank you so much for the support. I'm very proud of the work that we have done here as a staff. We haven't even been fully staffed, and they have done tremendous effort. And again, it couldn't have been possible without the help of the treasurer's office, without the help of our partners, and we're just really excited about going forward with this program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Elliott, and I'm the school facilities coordinator, and I'm actually here more to just answer any questions you have about the details of the program. They've covered all of the highlights.
All of the highlights.
All of them.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? Yes. Representative Springer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Prager, you mentioned the hardship portion, and I realize it's not funded. What is a hardship? What would that process be? What would the typical school look like and be that would access those funds or attempt to?
Chair Springer, on that, so first of all, let me say, with the hardship dollars, the way the legislation was written was that if there were any dollars left from the facility grant program that's currently within the state school fund, then any of those excess dollars would be shifted to the hardship grant program. I can tell you, at least from our preliminary estimates, we're not seeing any money that would be left over from that. So that's the reason I've said that it's gone unfunded. The legislation also speaks to a maximum of a $500,000 grant. So this is really to target those areas, unexpected collapse of a roof, areas that have tremendous impacts on a facility. Representative Springer, we haven't put the administrative rules together for that because we have focused on the other two, but our intent would be to really capture some of those things that you wouldn't typically see as a bonded, maybe not elevate to the amount of a capital type expenditure. Again, it could be those things that are completely unexpected.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon. Well,
first of all, thank you for being here, and thank you for all your work, everybody. I'm just trying to get a better feel. I threw out a lot of numbers, and I don't have them before me, but could you give me a feel for, you know, how I know there's huge numbers of schools out there that need this sort of service, and we put together this awesome program. So is it, are we taking a big bite out of the apple or just barely nibbling them around the edges?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, I think that there is a tremendous need. We look out at the school districts. There's 197 school districts in the state. This funding, which is half of it, approximately half of what we got, is going to fund 13 of the school districts. Again, I think the way we have proportioned it, again, it's supposed to be a leverage tool. I think that there is, again, a tremendous need. I think over time, what we're trying to do, part of the administrative rules is to move these dollars out to as many school districts as we can. So one of the things that we want to implement or have implemented is to ensure that once a school district has a matching dollars, they basically will be ineligible to go back and get another bite of the apple, that we want to be able to disperse that to as many school districts across the state as possible. In terms of the total need within the state, again, I use the report that we seen back in 2008 related to seismic, and it quoted $8 billion worth of need. And again, just as a comparison, this is $310 million that we're actually doing just with this one election. So again, if that were to continue, we could see somewhere, you know, up close to, I would say, $1 billion perhaps during the biennium. But again, it's going to be a slower process to be able to meet all of the needs throughout the state. And I don't know if Michael wants to add anything more in terms of the needs that he's seen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, yeah, it's about $8 billion as far as need. And I think the goal of the program is to be carefully managing the debt so we don't just take on too much at once as a state, and then we spread it out over several biennia. So, yes, we're taking smaller bites, but we're taking bites every time we go out so that we are addressing and reducing the deferred maintenance and capital costs of districts across the state.
Well, it's very important that you started taking those bites, too, so and it means a lot to the district. But I'm just trying to get a feel for how it is going to take many years to address this, obviously. So. Thank you for starting.
Any other questions? No? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have... Okay. Let me close the informational hearing on the school facilities expenditures, and we open an informational hearing on re-engaging out-of-school youth. Ms. Bell, she's coming up right now. Thanks for writing that all out.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Frederick, Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee, my name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Youth Development Council. And I'm here today with Cord Bucher and Bill Hansel from YDC staff to give you an overview of youth reengagement. So as you know, the YDC's mandate is such that we are to give policy recommendations and information on youth practices and best practices sort of statewide. And so today, this conversation that we're going to have to you around reengaging out-of-school youth, I believe is indeed a conversation, a statewide conversation about the policy direction that you all will want to go in with respect to reengaging out-of-school youth. So with that, we're going to give you an overview and then some specifics, but an overview of what the conversation is that's been going on around reengaging out-of-school youth. And we're going to start with the multiple ways in which out-of-school youth are defined. So in some instances, they're called disconnected youth. Some instances, they're called disengaged youth. In some areas, they're called dropout youth. So we have this sort of variety of ways in which we even speak about who these young people are. And so what we have here from the Center of Law and Social Policy is a definition that talks about out of school and disconnected. And if you take a look at this particular definition, it lends itself to what the council has been calling opportunity youth. And you know, we've come before you before to talk about opportunity youth being those young people who are out of school and not working between the ages of 16 and 24. And so the Center for Law and Social Policy basically uses that kind of same definition to talk about youth ages 16 to 24 who lack a high school diploma and are not enrolled in school and are detached from work. So that's a definition that's out there, somewhat being used at the national level and certainly around the country, being used in regional communities around the country. Now, in Oregon, we talk about what we call a dropout youth, and that has a definition in statute. And that's a student who has been enrolled in the current school year or was enrolled in the previous school year but did not attend school in the current year, is not a high school graduate, has not received the GED certificate, and has withdrawn from school. So again, another sort of catchment area of young people that we're calling out-of-school youth. Now, again, if you take a look at the national sort of statistics on this, 5.5 million youth in the country between the ages of 16 and 24 are out of school and out of work. And that's, again, and we've sort of given you this sort of scenario before, that's 1 in 7 youth, or about 13.8% of the youth in the country. Disconnected youth represent a huge impact and a high cost to taxpayers, and you can see that at $26.8 billion alone in 2013. And again, we've given you some of these statistics before when you talk about this, and we talk about the impact on our systems, on our social systems, on our juvenile justice systems. You know, on all of our systems, there's an impact when you take a look at the number of young people who are not in school and not working.
Ms. Bell, I want to point out one quick thing here. Mm-hmm. You make it clear that if a student has withdrawn from school, those are students who miss 10 consecutive days of school, and they're automatically dropped. That's not just deciding that you're missing one day or two here and there. It's 10 consecutive days.
I guess since we're already interrupted a little bit, may I ask one quick question?
Sure.
Just on, Iris, on your number, that 13.8%, and I'm trying to connect that with our high school graduation rate, which is like 72%. So that would mean 28% that are not graduating may or may not be working. So can you make those numbers work for me?
Chair Frederick, Representative Britton, we're going to get to that. We're going to break this down so you can see the those particular percentages, particularly when you talk about the total number of young people who haven't been working, who are not in school, and who've dropped out this last year, and numbers that we can then add to that for the number of kids who have not.
You're going to make it all add up for me.
I'm going to try.
All right.
I'm going to try.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. In regards to the 10 days, I have a question as it relates to the absentee policies per district. My understanding is those can be different by district, and I know that I've had some issues with constituents that have decided we're going to take a two-week-long vacation or we're going to do something, and the school district says that's not part of our policy. So what do you do in regard to that? Does that affect... Because then if it goes those 10 days, they drop them if it doesn't fall within their policy. Right. And does that affect part of what you're...
Chair Frederick, Representative Hack, well, actually what happens there is within that 10-day period, some of those youth can actually come back to school. They come back to school and they get re-enrolled. So, you know, when you take a look at that 10-day period, that's the 10-day period for saying, a school district saying they have dropped out, they are not at school. But they can come back and totally re-enroll. And so you're right, some of those numbers then become somewhat questionable as you move down to say who re-enrolled in that time period. And then, of course, there's an age sort of period in that. If you're 19 or older, you may not come back to re-enroll. And so everywhere along this sort of continuum, there are various aspects to what we try to call this out-of-school young person and how long it takes for us to begin to call them a dropout youth. So that, again, and we're going to try and get into a little of that.
Thank you.
But it gets a little, you have to tease out many of the variables when it comes to how we actually take a look at this. So when you take a look at what's happening, we're going to move on to, did we get to this one? When you take a look at what's happening with respect to the Department of Education's numbers, and here's where we get to a little bit of the question that you were asking, Representative Reardon. So last year, 7,649 of Oregon students dropped out of high school. And that number represents more students dropping out of high school than in the last decade. Now, we're looking into why that is. You know, why is it that within the last decade, more students have dropped out this last year than a 10-year period? So we're kind of trying to dig down into some of the reasons. Some of it is economic. Some of it is because they actually have gone on to work. Because of the need, but we really do want to know more precisely, you know, why is that happening? And look at that rate. That dropout rate is actually also at a high, all-time high for the state of Oregon. Now, here's another interesting dynamic to this dropout issue. So there's what is called a combined disadvantage classification. And so what we're seeing in that classification is 74.3% of all of the students who drop out fit into some category of that combined classification. They could be dropped out and economically disadvantaged. They could also be a student with disabilities. They could have all of these particular characteristics or one or more of these characteristics. But 74.3% of the students who are dropping out fit into these particular characteristics. And they're not unfamiliar to us. They're the same ones we've been looking at as we look at how are we going to help support those young people who are being impacted and who need resources around the state who fit into some of these particular categories. They are having the challenges, they are facing the barriers to learning, and we must do something to impact these young people. So now as we move forward in the next slide, I'm going to move you a little bit further down in the trajectory. So we were talking about 16 to 24. Now we're talking about 18 to 24. And when you talk about 18 to 24 and you start to talk about 19, 20, 21, 22, these are the young people who then can't go back to school. You know, they can't sort of walk back in the door and say, hi, I'm 19, I'm 20, I'd like a diploma. So they're showing up without high school diplomas or any kind of equivalency, and they're out there now. We have 42,000 young people who are out there now in that particular situation. And so for us, it really does become critical that we start to talk about how to re-engage all of these young people with all of the various aspects that we've been talking about, that combined disadvantage classification. We talk about the kinds of barriers that they have to learning. We talk about how we get the supports they need. And this is happening, again, statewide. So one of the things you'll find in our report to you today is that we're looking at the kinds of solutions that would be statewide in nature, not one size fit all, but definitely a statewide approach to how we begin to reengage young people. So now Cord is going to give you a little bit more of what's been happening nationally with this reengagement movement, this reconnection movement, because it has become a national effort. We're not the only state that's looking at their numbers and realizing we really do need to bring young people back to our schools and back to settings where they can actually receive certifications or certificates, where they can get equivalencies. We have far too many young people, not just in this state, but in the country, that are in this situation right now, who are really having an impact on our economy and an impact on their lives and the lives of their children as they move forward in life. So with that, Cord's going to give you a little bit more information on the re-engagement movement itself, and we're going to try and move then into, you know, what does that mean for Oregon?
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Frederick, Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee. My name is Cord Bucher, and I'm a workforce policy analyst with the Youth Development Council. And I'm going to speak a little bit about what's happening now in terms of re-engagement efforts nationally as well as here in Oregon. Nationwide, re-engagement as policy and practice has been growing considerably, and re-engagement programs throughout the country have shown effectiveness. Examples are found all over the place. They range from major metropolitan school districts, such as in Boston and Chicago, and there are some really exciting things happening in smaller cities like Dubuque, Iowa, and Allentown, Pennsylvania. The National League of Cities actually has been helping to convene a lot of the agencies and organizations and municipalities that are working on this, and the National League of Cities Reengagement Network has been providing some great resources for everyone who's trying to do this work. And this is an opportune time for us to talk about this, because Andrew Moore from the National League of Cities actually just published a book I have here on reengagement. This collects a lot of information and evidence about what's going on nationally, and there are some contributions from here in Oregon as well. And so, let's see, we're on the next slide here. So there are a few effective strategies that tend to be commonly found in reengagement programs. The first is to identify the dropouts and conduct outreach to them. In a lot of cases, the young people that we're talking about are hard to find. They're not at school. And depending on the community, it can be a challenge to reach them, but the work of finding those youth, tracking them down, and bringing them back is a big part of this. Assessing their needs, both educational and the social and psychological needs of youth, is an important first step once you've got them in the door. Referring them to educational options and support services that fit their needs. Supporting their re-enrollment in a best fit option, because not the same solution might not work for every student. And of course, providing ongoing support to keep them engaged once they are re-enrolled in school. I'd like to talk a little bit about what's happening in Portland, because all five of those functions can be found in what they're doing there. In Portland, you have multiple pathways to re-engagement. And so Portland has a reconnection center run by the district that provides resources and referral to families and young people who would like to re-engage in school. And they have a lot of options when they choose to come back. They can return to Portland public schools, high schools, to their home school. If that isn't the best fit for them, there are alternative programs as well that offer diploma and GED completion, and the Reconnection Center can work with the families and the student to figure out what the best option would be. There are also programs within PPS that can be utilized, and Portland Community College works closely with PPS and PCC's Links to College programs are another option that has shown effectiveness through Yes to College students can earn a GED and get help accessing college after they complete it. And through Gateway to College, they can earn their high school diploma and college credit. So there are a variety of ways in PPS School District that students are able to re-engage and find the option that is the best fit for them. Now, broadening out to, I'm going to the next slide, thank you. Broadening to look at Oregon as a whole, there are generally two types of strategies we're seeing. Open door school re-enrollment, which can be, you know, simply allowing a student who has dropped out to return to school. And sometimes there are alternative options and programs that might assist them with their re-engagement and provide them with more specialized services. There is also active outreach, which can include canvassing, home visits, a variety of outreach methods. There are a few promising approaches that are noted in looking at re-engagement programs nationwide, and you'll see a lot of these here in the state. That, of course, includes the outreach specialist. That's the person who's finding these youth, bringing them back. And that's a really special skill because you have to be able to communicate with the young people and with the schools, with the administrators, and other organizations that are doing this work. Of course, social media and web-based technology has been really helpful in reaching students where they're at. Mm-hmm. Canvassing, going out and finding youth where they congregate, home visits, of course, high school and community-based organization partnerships. One thing that's really important here, too, is peer referral. For youth who re-engage, their success can be contagious, and they can be the best outreach specialists you can find because they bring their friends back in. So efforts that really leverage that have been shown to be successful. One emerging practice that I want to note is connecting workforce and educational re-engagement. PPS and work systems have been working closely together to try to find ways to align this, and under the new Department of Labor, WIOA, youth employment funding, re-engagement is considered an acceptable service. And so I think there's a possibility that you could see more collaboration between workforce programs and school districts working to re-engage youth who are disconnected from education. This morning, I actually listened to some testimony in the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor, and Tony Frazier, who runs Insight here in Salem, mentioned having reached out to the district here to partner on re-engagement, and it sounds like there's going to be some work done there. So I think that this will be something we see emerging here in Oregon and throughout the country. Thank you. Moving further out, there are some examples we can find around the country of policy statewide that has been shown to be effective. In Washington State, their open doors re-engagement policy, it provides a blueprint for state legislation, and it removed a lot of the barriers that prevented districts and other organizations from re-engaging youth. Colorado Youth for a Change has pioneered very active re-engagement approach via outreach specialists. They go out, they find the youth, they bring them back in, and they support them to help them continue and be successful.
I was at the meeting where the Washington State was presented, and I'm just hoping we can just steal their legislation, and or at least borrow it and give it to legislative council. How's that for tactful?
Yeah. Well, Chair Doherty, one of the things that we've been talking about is reaching out to them and taking a look at that legislation and finding out where we can actually take some quantum leaps forward with respect to sort of speeding up some of our processes. As you know, they've been in that business for 5 years.
Yes.
So that's 5 years worth of working to re-engage young people and 5 years basically worth of legislation that has helped them to get to that point. So,
and to see what the pitfalls are and things that have to be improved. So
exactly.
I just wanted to make an additional note as we work on re-engagement here in Oregon. I don't want us to forget about the practices and efforts happening in the tribal nations. And so I wanted to highlight one project in particular that we at YDC are familiar with, that being Cow Creek Tribes Education and Workforce Center, which has been providing support to tribal members who are seeking GED certificates. It provides them with help registering for classes, tutors them, mentors them, and works with them to achieve high school completion, get into post-secondary education, and I know they also do some connections with workforce programming there as well. Mm-hmm. And that's that is the end of my remarks. I'd like to pass this along to my colleague, Bill Hansel, who's going to talk a little bit more about the data and suggestions for next steps here in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Chairperson Doherty, Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hansel, the young good-looking one. I am the Youth Policy Analyst for the Youth Development Commission, and I will begin speaking about why re-engage dropouts. Reengaging dropouts is the right thing to do. Dropouts consume state and community resources at an exorbitant amount. If we apply national estimates to Oregon and then apply a $2,000 reengagement cost to just the students that dropped out last year, we estimate that there could be upwards of $350 million in saving based on these national estimates. Also, it's essential for the 40-40-20 goals. If we keep this pool, 42,000 currently in Oregon, 18 to 24, without a dropout, puts this goal out of reach. There's no possible way it can be met if we have 42,000 individuals without even a high school diploma. So we need something there. Skilled workers for local economies, closing the opportunity gap by virtue of doing that increases the skills of laborers, which more closely aligns them to the skill set that's needed in the upcoming and economy that's with us now. There's a gap between what our employers are looking for and the basic skill set that laborers can provide. So re-engaging these youth young adults increases their skill sets and makes them more employable. And again, it's the right thing to do. There's a need for a coordinated re-engagement strategy, and this speaks to the difference between efforts to improve graduation rates and a re-engagement of dropouts, because the graduation rate and the dropout rate are not the inverse of each other. It's possible to increase the graduation rate and at the same time see increases in the dropout rate. So graduation rates and dropout rates are different, although related issues. For example, Oregon has improved its graduation rate 5% since the 2012-2013 school year, which we've heard a lot about when it was the lowest reported graduation rate in the nation. So we've improved that 5%, and yet at the same time currently, we have the highest number of dropouts and the highest dropout rate that we've had in the last decade. So that shows conclusively that they're two different issues. So efforts to improve graduation rates are great, but they don't necessarily impact or re-engage dropouts. Here's some information by county. The range is a high of 17.59% for Crook County and a low of less than 0.5% for Wallowa. A couple other county rates that might be of interest. Marion County has a 5.62% rate. Josephine County has a 5.02%. Umatilla County has 4.3% dropout rate. Linn County has a 4.18% dropout rate. Multnomah County has a 4.15% dropout rate. The state's average, again, is 4.26%. Clackamas County has a 3.67%. Washington County, 2.97%. Union County, 1.67%. And as we said, Wallowa wins the competition with a less than 0.5% dropout.
So, Mr. Hansel, when you have that, it means that of all of the, I mean, and schools vary, but the total county, for example, is that means 2 point whatever kids drop out. Is that what that?
No, the dropout rate is based is an event count. Mm-hmm. So it's saying of the students that were in fall membership that year, mm-hmm. how many of them dropped out, and they calculate the rate based on that. So,
okay.
On these county calculations, they're taking the school districts within those counties, saying how many kids were present for the fall membership count,
and
how many of them then dropped out, and
Thank
that
you.
Produces your rate. I have made some geographical regions. Now, these are somewhat arbitrary. They're just my regions of the state. But for Southern Oregon, and we'll get to a map later that will show the county layouts of these, but just, again, a geographical. Southern Oregon has a 5.88% Central Oregon, 4.92% dropout rate. The Willamette Valley has a 3.99%. Northeastern Oregon has a 3.8%. The North Coast has a 3.67%. And then Southeastern Oregon has a 1.97%. If we just look at the divide between east and west of the Cascades, the east of the Cascades has slightly higher than state average at 4.38%. West of the Cascades is slightly lower than the state average at 4.23%. As we think about developing a statewide re-engagement policy, as you know, there are wide variations in school district size. Locations of state universities and community college vary, and community resources vary. This indicates that a regional approach is best suited as a re-engagement strategy. The regional approach allows for accommodating the difference both in the population types, the metro versus rural, and then the community resources, and again kind of ties them to the layout of an existing university and community college structure, and then also speaks to the difference that counties like Umatilla County that may have 8 or 9, 10 districts versus Multnomah County with a single large district type or several large districts can do. So the regional approach kind of brings it all together and allows some local control and then some combined efforts to approach the re-engagement from. Here's the map that I spoke out before. Again, this is somewhat arbitrary. This is just my breakdown of kind of how the regional layout might be, both taking into concern some geographic relations of how obviously Klamath Falls and Ontario are a long ways apart. So that's some of the considerations of where it looked like there was some geographic similarities along with population similarities that would allow for, again, just a potential model for a regional re-engagement efforts.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, as has been said, you know, we don't have a formal statewide policy around re-engaging youth. We know that this is an emerging topic and it's an emerging issue that's coming before our state. And so part of the recommendation that the council is going to be making to you is that we start to consider how we will approach this issue, this topic, because we're going to hear more and more about the numbers of these youth. We know, again, we can't use a cookie-cutter approach because, just as Bill was saying, you know, Multnomah County with one school district, and then you have another county that has, you know, another smaller county, but it has, you know, 5 school districts. So we have to take a look at this as we take a look at the communities we are trying to support. We also need to take a look at what Cord was saying about this whole notion of a passive approach as opposed to a more aggressive approach. In many communities, you know, you don't have the resources. You have a single individual who maybe can make some phone calls to try and find a young person, as opposed to an all-out effort with various levels of involvement, whether or not you're looking at alternative schools, whether you're looking at community colleges being involved. So we really do have to take a look at what the resources are in communities to try and bring young people back to school and or back to work. And so we again think that that would necessarily mean that you're looking at how local communities would go about doing this or how they would propose to go about doing this, and then how we could support their efforts with the use of some of our resources and with the use of funding to support them in the kinds of ways that could help bring young people back to school and or work, which is something, again, we very definitely are going to need to be able to do, because we're going to hear more and more about this and the impact that it has on our state, and we do need to bring these young people back. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Any questions to the panel? Representative McClain.
Well, as I was listening to you, one of the things that I've been working on this summer and looking at and visiting are the 13 virtual schools that we have in the state, mm-hmm. and also the Department of Ed also has a virtual experience that can happen with long-distance learning, either for a complete program or single classes. Right. And so have you incorporated that in your work as far as opportunities or as far as support that could happen to students in any of these regions?
Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, yes, when we take a look at that, and the way in which we've sort of looked at that is as we take a look at what local communities want to do or propose to do, that certainly could be an option. So we're not ruling out the fact that virtual schools have a role to play in how we bring young people back to school and back to the workforce. So again, very much driven by how we engage local communities around the state with respect to this particular issue.
If I could just follow up with that for just a minute. My point is that we all agree that if we have a need, then we need to consider all the resources possible. Mm-hmm. And they're both, I mean, the local schools, some of them have their own online academies. Mm-hmm. And some of them are utilized or contract being a host school by utilizing one of these virtual online academies. So I just, if we're going to do this, right. If you're going to be asking for money to do this, or if it's already in the budget, I just want to make sure that we mm-hmm. we look at everything and not just a scattering. Absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm totally for local control. But again, we're looking for local opportunity and state opportunity. Otherwise, we wouldn't at the state be doing this.
Right.
So I think we should try to connect and integrate what those resources are.
Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, I would agree. I absolutely agree that we do need to take a look at those resources. And when I talked about local communities, it was basically around how they go about engaging these young people. Mm-hmm. But we do need a statewide system of some sort. We do need that continuity and alignment so that we don't have various scattered versions of how we go about looking at how to reengage these young people. So duly noted, and as we move forward with this conversation, which is what it is right now, as we move forward with this conversation, we will need to take a look at the various opportunities that present themselves for reengaging young people.
Okay, we have Representative Frederick, Representative Bretto, and then Representative Springer and Reardon. Let's go this way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we've talked about this and you've seen it, but I continue to want to know, for instance, what is it about Wallawa? I mean, I know you can tell me a lot. I know. But I that actually speaks to another thing. What is it upstream? What is having these students leave? And what kind of exit interview are we having with these students to say, why are you leaving? What does that data tell us? I have a feeling you know.
Chair Doherty and Representative and Vice Chair Frederick, I would like to respond to that. Although I don't have local data available at this time for that, and that's something I'd love to locate and bring back. I do have information from 2014-15, some national data from the Reengagement Network about what they saw in terms of the factors leading to youth dropping out of high school. And the most common predictive indicator, the thing that they saw most often in terms of what led to students being dropped out or a characteristic of dropouts was poverty, free and reduced price lunch. That was by far the most common.
What was that again?
Oh, free and reduced lunch status. So that would be low-income students. That was followed by those youth who were currently or formerly involved in the juvenile justice system, and then those who were either homeless or high-mobility youth. And the next highest factor was those involved with the foster care system. So if you look at those four characteristics, those were the highest, most common predictors of dropouts among those programs nationally that reported on it.
Follow up. I understand the national situation, but you brought up the fact that we have the highest rate in 10 years. And I'd like to know, not on the national level, but on the Oregon level, on the state level, what are we seeing I mean, we're looking, being predictable, having the prediction related to socioeconomic status, juvenile justice contacts, are fine. I'd like to know what it is that's going on in Oregon that's seeing this kind of an increase, and if there's a way to have an exit interview, if you will, with some of those students to say, okay, why did you decide you needed to leave? That I'd find most interesting, because if we can do something about that, then we won't have as many to re-engage. So.
Chair Doherty and Chair Frederick, I agree, and that is something we're actively working to find out more about. I would also add that re-engagement and dropout prevention can be working hand in hand, and the efforts to reduce the dropout rate can be coupled with those efforts to re-engage students. I think those two processes can actually be aligned, and in some of the places where there's really great re-engagement work being done, the outreach specialists are working with students who are noted as being at risk for various reasons. But we are right now trying to figure out exactly why it's peaked so much, and we'd be very happy to report back when we find out.
Thank you.
Representative Bredo, who represents Wallawa.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Nice job.
Yeah, you know, that is interesting, Wallawa, but you know, that's a community up there that is very close-knit. It is when you talk about a community, they're a community. You know, I went to a pie auction to raise money for someone whose business had burned down, and on a Sunday afternoon, $69,000 they raised. I mean, and this is out of a small community. Mm-hmm. I mean, they stand together, they look out for each other, and matter of fact, it's high unemployment up there too, you know, but there's a lot of people that work two and three jobs just because they want to live in that area. But actually, Lou, or Representative Fredericks, asked the exact same question I was going to. You know, 10 years, this thing isn't getting better. You know, it looks like we're hemorrhaging. You know, how do we stop the bleeding rather than, you know, trying to fix it? You know, in manufacturing, it's always, you know, when you make a mistake, it's can we salvage it? And then it's how did it happen and how do we prevent it from happening again? It's a pretty simple process, but it's almost the same thing here. You know, so if you can diagnose the problem and say, how do we start fixing this so that we're not spending lots and lots of money, so we're not wasting a lot of lives in building up a community. So. Mm-hmm. But I was going to say, I appreciate you taking this on and going in the direction you are as far as trying to fix this. But yeah, same thing. At the same time, you can't keep going down this road if you can go back and fix the problem.
Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative Barreto, that's exactly the point. You know, the council itself has been taking a look at how to provide resources and make investments around the state to keep kids in school, to keep young people in school and focused in school. At the same time, as we see this emerging issue come up around reengagement, we also are trying to take a look at how we bring those young people back to school and back to work. So it's a sort of a dual process of let's look at what's happening at the level that kids are sort of this 10-year period where kids have sort of spiked in terms of leaving school. And let's see if we can stop that hemorrhaging. And at the same time, let's go out and find those young people who have already left and try to reengage them and get them back involved in school or work.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been sitting here chewing on this question or this thought for probably the last 10 minutes now, and I can't turn it into a question. And so I just want to put it out there and get some feedback, if I could, some thoughts. And we touched on it talking about Wallawa. I remember not that many years ago being in a teacher lunchroom. Principal was in there and a slew of teachers, small K-8 community school. Mm-hmm. And the kids that started in kindergarten left that K-8 with the same group of kids in eighth grade. And you had no choice as far as I don't like this teacher or I don't like this kid, I have to stay in that group. And the conversation that I was privy to was pretty amazing. One of their kids, mm-hmm. when he got to the high school, dropped out after whatever, 2-3 years. And they were upset, they were angry, they were scared, they were sad, they were all sorts of stuff. And they were going, they tracked him down, and they were going to find him and figure out why he dropped out. They were going to get him back in. Part of that, they expressed, was their 9-year investment. And the bigger part, of course, was we have a kid that maybe we have failed because he hasn't continued the process. And that's the quandary I'm finding myself in. You have this group of people saying, it's my problem. They left my building, but this is my problem. I have to address this problem. Yet we're having a conversation about a program to address problems. And this is where I can't come up with a question in it. Give me some feedback there, and I'll bet you it's the same type of teacher and administrator sitting around the table in Wallowa County as was sitting around the table at Lacombe saying, our kid isn't making it, and we've got to go fix this.
Mm-hmm. Representative Chair Doherty, Representative Springer. No, I think part of that has to do with community and the involvement of community in our young people's lives and how we do that and how we engage community more and how we bring parents back into the conversations about what's happening with our young people in our schools and how we provide the supports not only for parents and community to engage schools, because you know there's been in some cases disconnection between parents and schools, not in all cases, but I do believe that strong community and strong community involvement, including parents, is part of the solution to this and part of the reasons why I think we could see a shift if we were to bring parents involved and bring them more involved into the school system. Now, part of also what's happening, and I would say this is happening in schools perhaps up and down the I-5 corridor, is this the whole notion of what's happening with respect to suspensions and expulsions and that particular part of a component of this where young people are suspended and they don't come back. And so, and then where's the parent? So you have to involve the parent, you have to involve the community in that as well. So where we have seen the community not disengage from the school, we are perhaps seeing more and more young people also disengage mm-hmm. from the school. So I think that's also the approach that we have to take a look at when we start talking about reengagement. What role will the community play in taking a look at how we bring young people back, how we keep young people connected to schools? There's a significant, huge role that they have to play in this process, for sure.
And community doesn't mean a small community.
No, community's no. Community. Yeah. Right, exactly.
Okay, Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and all that you're doing. And I, too, have a hard time formulating my question, so please bear with me. But so we have 45,000 some students or dropouts, and I guess they dropped out for a reason. Mm-hmm. They probably didn't like the product that we collectively were providing them in the past, or they had problems outside of the school that maybe caused them to leave. So I'm trying to think with my marketing hat on, what type of, what can we do to sell this product, or how can we do a better job of making sure that these potential customers see a value in what it is we want to provide? Because I can see it, you know, you come on back, we're going to provide you some training of some kind, you know, your life is going to be better, you'll start paying taxes, all these things. So how do we really have a message for these kids? Is there a good match between what they want and what our system provides? So if you can digest my question, you're wonderful.
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, I'm going to let Court answer that probably more specifically than I, but just in terms of in general, when we take a look at how we sort of entice or invite young people back, I think it has to be on their terms, and I think we have to give them a number of different options and a variety of solutions that fit their life and their life story and their life condition. To some degree, you know, you see young people who drop out, they drop out for reasons where they have to go to work to help the family. You see them drop out because they're having difficulties communicating in the classroom. That there are a variety of reasons why, but what we have to do is sort of to re-engage them and invite them back, and invite them back on their terms and show them an environment that can re-engage them in a way that fits and meets their needs. And I think many of them have left because they just did not see that the school was meeting their needs in the ways in which they needed to have the supports. And so, again, we're going to do more work on looking at some of these core reasons why, but we're also going to have to bring them back based on acknowledging those reasons and then trying to ameliorate some of those difficulties, those barriers that they had in the first place. So that's part of what we're going to have to do. Court, I don't know if you want to get any more specific with respect to some of the processes that the re-engagement networks use. So there is a whole process that people go through when they set up these sort of re-engagement centers that say, here's the approach you take to re-engaging a young person. But at the same time, that person who's coming back is going to look to see if those supports are there, or if this is the same old thing that I left before, why would I want to come back to it? So we're going to have to begin to take a look at really what were some of those reasons and begin to take a look at how we help to mitigate some of those.
Because it looks like the highest dropout rates are almost like the last-ditch effort, alternative schools, Connections Academy, that kind of thing. And so it's like those are the ones that have the highest percentage of dropouts.
Do you want to make any more comments?
Sure, Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon. I actually thought that was a pretty fantastic answer. But I would add a couple of points. I was excited to hear in the earlier discussion about ESSA that there's this process really involving the voices of families, students, and the community in trying to shape what schools look like in the years ahead. And I think that kind of going to your question of how we can improve the product, I think that that might be a piece of it. And it looks like one of the elements that we are seeing is a desire for more career preparation within school, the desire for STEM programming and CTE programming. I believe we're seeing some pretty exciting results in graduation rates, particularly with CTE programs here in Oregon. And especially in reducing disparities in graduation rates. Another thing I would add, to go back to Representative McLean's question about online schools, some of the programs nationally have found that a combination of virtual schools and classroom activity has been really helpful. And for students who are unable to attend a full-time school, there's a real need for programs that offer a variety of options. And that could be programs for young parents, programs for youth who are working to support a family, who are primary caregivers, as well as youth who may have disabilities, who have anxiety issues, who deal with bullying. There's a whole litany of things that might cause a student to find that the current product or what's available to them isn't working. And so a lot of the work around re-engagement must be really individualized to identify what issues have led to a student leaving school and what sort of things can be put in place to bring them back and help them to be successful. So I think that it's both a wide lens look at how we can make the schools that we have more responsive, but also finding ways to address the needs of individual students as we bring them back in.
Mm-hmm. Representative Doherty.
Go ahead.
And members of the committee, I also wanted to speak to the fact that we can tell you any manner of descriptive terms for these students, what their race, ethnicity is, their economic disadvantage status. And in fact, one of the most interesting things that we can tell you that goes a little bit beyond the descriptive and approaches the why question is when they drop out. And they actually drop out after the May 1st count, which is the spring membership count, which is indicative of that count being related to ADM calculations. And this is the thing that I think that comes into bringing an effective package, if you will, or looking at it, is what of the dropouts have to do with systemic or statutory barriers to fully engaging these youth. And some of them are the accountability measures. Districts view re-engagement of these dropouts as punitive. Many times if they re-engage these youth, they double count on negative statistics that they view as, that are counted in accountability measures like attendance, If they re-engage that youth and they drop out again, the dropout is an event count, so they will actually be counted as a dropout again in the next year cycle. If they re-engage this youth and that youth graduates in 6 years instead of the four-year rate, they don't count as a graduate in the graduation count because they weren't a member of that four-year cohort. So the question becomes, what incentive does the district have to re-engage this youth? And so the product might be a good one, but then where's the motivation, or what statutory pieces are in place that can be removed that allow the districts to do the work that they would actually like to do without viewing it as a consequence? And part of that, again, going back to online schools, that's a regional approach where you have maybe many different districts that, you know, the student was expelled from, say, Elgin, they can't go back to that school. That's the only school in the entire district. There are no alternative schools. There are no other options. But that's where an online class, you know, online offerings can step in. And now, because of a regional effort, you have that ability where before, as a single district, they had no options for that student. And so these are the type of things that we're looking at. And these are the type of things that we hope to be able to identify in the way that Washington State has in many cases of removing those statutory barriers that prevented districts from engaging these students fully.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that this really calls for a response. I don't know if some of the items you just mentioned as far as counting of the students in ADM are administrative rule issues or legislative issues, but I know by all means it certainly sounds like a first step and the low-hanging fruit, if you will, to be looking at to address so a district doesn't feel penalized. Whether they should or they should be worried about that is another conversation. I don't think that conversation is useful to us, but what I do think is useful is to look at these areas. I do know in weighting of students, much of that is administrative rule, much of it is law, and we need to ferret that out, because if there's something we can remove to make that easier for kids to re-engage, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. why would we not mm-hmm. jump on that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the presentation. This is the first one that you've given on this particular edge, and I think it's really important, and I don't think any of us would disagree that we always want to help as long as we can to keep people being successful. But I guess as a new freshman for at least the rest of this year, that it's a situation where, you know, we talk about it from cradle to career. That's our responsibility. 3 to 20, 3 to 24, you know, I mean, it's a situation where we have so many resources, and so looking for, you know, taking barriers away that can help us utilize our resources better at an earlier time, I think is brilliant, great, wonderful, spectacular, good strategy. But I think we have to remember that as we go through this and think about a statewide or a regional-wide review where we might get, like our ESDs, an opportunity to do some things we can't with single schools or single districts, that's where we should start and hopefully stay, because the situation is that we only have so many resources, and those resources we're now trying to spread over 24 years versus 20 years versus 18 years, and so I just think we have to address it and talk about that right up front. The other issue about blended schooling, I will tell you that right now, out of the 6 or 7 that I've visited, out of the 13, the blended programs were superior from the get-go as far as how much drop-in there actually was and what kind of drop-in or actual contact they had one-on-one with staff or in any way, shape, or form with a human being versus Skyping or emailing or anything else. There's the exception of, you know, I heard about the Olympic skier, the Olympic skater. A lot of Olympic folks go to these schools. But it's a situation where I heard, you know, those kids cannot be contacted on a weekly basis. It doesn't need to be weekly, but there needs to be a blended approach. And so it's a situation where, again, I hope you guys are thinking about, we have the same amount of resources and we have a larger responsibility that we're saying we might accept.
Yeah. Representative Barreto, then Representative Reardon.
Just one last thing. A couple of years ago, I think these kids that came in here were from Representative Frederick's district, and there was one black boy, and he said, you know, he was headed down the wrong road. He said, and then I had a teacher who cared about me mm-hmm. and invested time. And I don't think I'll ever forget that, you know, because that's what changed him. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Representative Reardon.
Just a question on the you're going to be assessing and referring to a different variety of programs. Do we have it might be that some people, not me of course, but some people might think that okay, these people, all 45,000, have dropped out. So because of that, they only have limited potential to achieve. Would you talk about the opportunities for success that these people that come back into the program, how far can they go? And how far can we help them go?
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, I think they can go all the way through mm-hmm. post-secondary education. Many of them just need the opportunity to come back, to reengage, get the supports that they need, and there's no limit to what can happen and what they can achieve. We've seen that happen. We've seen that happen in the state. We've seen that happen across the country, where with the right supports and with the right engagement and the right kind of mentoring with respect to adults and adults engaging these young people, I think that they could definitely go on. And so here's where that 40-40-20 changes. They may not impact the 20, but they definitely impact the other 240. Mm-hmm. And so where we miss the boat because they're already out of high school doesn't mean that they don't come back to community college or they don't come back to a four-year institution. So reengaging them and getting them back into a four-year or a two-year community college still adds to that 40 and that 40 for us in that state. So they're not lost to us when they leave high school, and that's the whole point. The point is to try to bring them back and reengage them.
Thank you. That's the message I wanted everybody to hear.
Because I know when I taught dropouts, it was like two things. One was they couldn't keep up with the work, they couldn't read. And so that's why the big emphasis on early reading. And two, there was nothing that really is at the high school level drew them in. And I taught North Clackamas, so they had a lot of programs at the Skill Center that brought the kids back in. But, you know, it's like for some odd reason, kids did not jump out of bed every morning and go, oh, I get to go to her history class. But welding and auto mechanics and carpentry and that kind of thing brought them back in. So,
mm-hmm. And we're finding that. We're finding that the young people who are engaged in CTE activities mm-hmm. have a higher rate of graduation and achievement than in just regular sort of school environment. So we're looking at CTE as being a significant way in which to reengage mm-hmm. young people.
Well, it sounds like you've got support from this committee for your projects. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we close the informational hearing on reengagement of students. And we have, for the good of the order, I know that Representative Hack just got back from a conference on early childhood. Would you like to give us a quick, brief overview?
Sure. Representative Peluso and I both went. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic. It's the first of a couple of these that we're going to go to. And it was an early learning fellowship. And listening to this presentation just defines even more clearly in my mind the need for early education and making sure that all children enter school ready to learn and can read by the third grade. A lot of what we talked about were what other states were doing. And it was nice to see that Oregon is moving in the right direction. We're not way behind other folks. So I think that was refreshing. The only piece that I think we both probably took away that we can do more work on is the birth to eight. Mm-hmm. We've been really focused on pre-K and those things, but there's also that child care component and making sure that we're reaching out and providing teaching and opportunities to child care providers who have that first, a lot of the first touch and time with children that don't have the opportunity to learn some of these basic skills. The connectivity starts at zero. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting, and I think we've got some work to do there, but I think we both left feeling like we're on the right track, and yes, there's some more that we can do, but we've also got to stay the course in what we've started mm-hmm. and see that through. But it was It was really good.
Okay, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
Just very briefly, that is nice to hear. It was a few years ago. The person's not on this committee. Myself and somebody did that fellowship program, and when we attended, Oregon was starting the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. We were doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very good. Okay. Good to hear. Progress. Okay, that's it. Okay, with that, I adjourn the committee.